Welcome to another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. My name is H.F. Mason. I'm a general surgeon and chief quality officer for Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
And I'm Jake Lancaster, an internal medicine physician and the chief medical officer for the Baptist Medical Group.
Well, guys, today we're so excited. We have as our guest Nigel Thurlow. Nigel is an expert in organizational design. He's an author, a speaker. He's a consultant in industry in business agility. He was the first chief of agile at Toyota. As I said, he's an author of numerous books. He's trained a ton of people in lean, agile, scrum, and flow. And speaking of flow, that's going to be our topic today is flow and value in healthcare. This is going to be the first of a three-part series with Nigel. So we're really looking forward to speaking with you, Nigel. And why don't you just give us a little history of your background?
Yeah, sure. The fact I've done so much and as you read out means I'm old. That's the basic construct there. But now I was very lucky. I've had a career with Toyota, both as a consultant and as a what we call a team member, an internal person. And intermixed in between those different times with Toyota, I've done some other interesting things in industry, in corporate life, in manufacturing. You mentioned some of the agile methodologies or agile techniques there. We can even get into that. Although my advice to everybody is don't do Scrum in the operating room. People will die. So that's not the place to do these experiments in the OR. I had a long career in project management and digital and electronics back in the old days when things were still on binary punch tape, and then gradually found that management paid more money, so sort of drifted in that direction, and then realized the world was truly broken and maybe I could try and learn about how to fix some of these challenges. And that sort of took me more in the lean thinking direction. Lucky enough to get hired by Toyota out in Europe many years ago in the early 2000s. And as I say, fulfilled many roles with them, both as a consultant and as a team member. And really that transformed my career. I owe a lot of what I do to Toyota. And latterly, I started sort of doing a lot of research into flow. We've written books on flow. And flow is a construct. It's not a methodology. It's like gravity. It just exists. You know, it's we can enable it. And there's lots of topics we can talk around that. And a couple of the things that interest me, which is why I was interested to talk to you on these topics, is that I do a lot of studying in complex adaptive systems. So the systems that are constantly evolving and changing and, you know, unpredictable, even chaotic at times. And so in the healthcare industry, that's clearly an aspect of a complex adaptive system, or it's indicative of a complex adaptive system. So that sort of interested me. And my work now is really trying to help organizations understand how to manage in complexity. You can't eliminate it. It's just not possible. It's a feature of the system. But how we can manage more effectively within that.
Well, yeah, Nigel, you've certainly, have done a lot in your career. But I think the topic that we have this week and for the three-part series is going to be your biggest challenge. What is value in healthcare? I think we could have a 20-part series on what that is, but we're going to try to tackle it in 30 minutes for this first part of the series. And you know, I think one of the things we really have to think about is value for who. There's a lot of different actors in the healthcare ecosystem when compared to, you know, a traditional manufacturer or or a merchant that's selling something to somebody else. So there's a lot of different players that all have a different opinion about what value is in the healthcare system. Can you give us just your insights on how you define value in healthcare?
Well, I can give you some thoughts. I'm not sure whether my definition would be valuable. I mean, I'm a patient and I pay just shy of $3,000 a month for healthcare for my wife and I. And this year I've already spent my $5,000 maximum out of pocket because of a minor surgery earlier in the year and then some, you know, routine tests. So I'm very familiar with how I perceive value in healthcare when I'm sort of shelling out around $40,000 a year just to ensure I can receive healthcare. So I asked myself the question in preparation with that. I said, who is the... Because when we define value as what the customer is willing to pay for, and value is always perceptible from the customer's lens. I mean, even Deming talked about this back in the 1950s. And so what is the customer willing to pay for in healthcare? And how does that translate to outcomes that matter to patients that are delivered efficiently, safely, and respectfully? So that was it, you know, but I was looking at it from a basic lean lens or lean thinking lens. And then I started to think, well, who is the customer? Because if you are a healthcare provider, as you folks are, and experts in that field, do you see the patient as the customer, the consumer of those services? Or do you consider the person paying for those services, the customer consuming those services? So I'm meaning the insurance companies. Now, if you're a self-pay patient, sometimes you're branded more like a leper. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, because, of course, you are not guaranteed to be able to pay for the services that you are being sold by the provider, where the insurance company, you're pretty much guaranteed to get paid the agreed rates, yada, yada. So I think that's the first thing I really want to dig into is who is the doctor serving? Are they serving the patient needs? And I think most doctors would say, yes, we are. We care about sustaining life and curing disease and illness and problems and treating ailments. But are they answering to the administrators of the healthcare authority or the healthcare body? And the providers of the budget, so meeting the budgets, meeting the certain KPIs and OKRs of the organization, or are they serving the insurance companies, or indeed the admins of the hospitals and healthcare businesses that are acting as proxies for the insurance company? And I think there's a real systemic pressure there for different types of models and how the medical profession is incentivized. Well, I'm sure when you become doctors and surgeons and people become nurses and you look at the Hippocratic Oath, you start to think about serving the needs of the people who have health problems. But then these pressures of the systems come in and start to manipulate and control the decisions you can make. So these are the sort of thoughts I've been having. I don't know. I mean, what does that spark in your minds as medical professionals immediately?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, who is the customer? You have to really consider both the patient and the payer, the insurance company, whoever, customers. There's certain things that we need to do for the patient, and then there's certain things that we need to do because the insurance company tells us we have to do them. Sometimes there is conflict between those two decisions, or the insurance company wants us to do things that we might not have done had they not been the one to kind of demand it, and, you know, as part of our value-based care arrangements or some other prior authorization agreements that come into play. So it can get tough because you have two masters in one sense. You have what you want to do for the patient. You have what the insurance company is willing to pay you to do. And it's a balancing act, and there is conflict a lot. That conflict, I think, causes a lot of the friction in healthcare. A lot of the, we're talking about flow, a lot of the restriction in the flow of healthcare and how it can be delivered efficiently. And, you know, it's one of the things that makes healthcare so challenging is that you do have those two masters that you have to satisfy. Jeff.
I've never really thought of it like that, but that's so true. I think we ultimately say, okay, our ultimate customer is that patient that we're taking care of. But yes, we also we have to serve the payer. And I do think that, you know, as payers are getting away from the traditional fee for service, because it used to be everything was volume driven. I mean, you know, the more you worked, the more you got paid, regardless of the quality or the value that you were providing to the patient. And now I think the insurance companies are figuring that out, is that they're trying to become more aligned with the quality of care that we're providing for those patients.
I think, you know, you mentioned fee for service models, and I confess I did some research before meeting you guys today, because, you know, I'm talking to to deep experts in the field, and I'm not a medical professional and I don't work in the medical industry. I focus more on helping organizations figure out how to eliminate all that waste in the system, the bureaucracy and the red tape and the non-value-added activity, which is crucial in your industry. But you're talking about in-fee or fee-for-service models. Now, the danger with that, of course, we talk about incentives. I do a lot of work in the corporate sector, and of course, incentives drive behavior of leaders within organizations because they're, you know, how much am I going to get paid? What is my status likely to be at the end of this period of assessment? And will I get my stock options and whatever else they're incentivized to focus on? And when we talk about value, when we talk about the customer, we want to be incentivizing the maximum value delivery for that consumer of our services, and that's really the customer. And I have a simple, and this is a challenging one because I have a simple definition of a customer: they give you money. Now, if you think about who gives you money, that really skews the conversation about who really is the customer in the healthcare sector. The customer, the patient is the vehicle for you getting paid, but the person predominantly paying you, if we discount co-pays and co-insurance, is the insurance company. They're paying the lion's share and the guaranteed chunk of cash. And so the danger is that within these fee-for-service models, that doctors may be incentivized to recommend more procedures to boost revenue, especially in high-cost specialities, cancer care and that type of thing. And there was a study, I actually wrote this down. There was a study in 2018, it was the JAMA analysis, suggests that 20% of procedures in the US may be low value, driven partly by financial incentives or defensive medicine, you know, fear of malpractice, that type of thing. So I don't know, what do you think? Because there's a real skew there about who's paying, and is the patient just the method by which we get paid, or is the value we're delivering the ultimate quality healthcare for that patient? You know, minimal pain, quick recovery, clear post-op, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly muddy. You know, that we do get paid from the insurance companies, but the patient is obviously paying the insurance company in the form of premiums, etc. So there's a little bit of a transitive property where that, you know, they're paying the insurance, they're paying for some of their healthcare. So the customer is paying too, but maybe just not directly like the insurance company is. And so it certainly is skewed. And when you think of, you know, the fee for service versus the, what is, you know, now value based care that insurance companies in the US have really been trying to move to, but we've been doing it slowly, probably for over 15, 20 years. We've not really made as much progress as people had hoped. Value-based care also has some of its challenges. So the average, you cited that study in JAMA, there's another study where it was under the value-based care arrangements that a lot of these commercial payers have with healthcare providers now. A primary care physician may be responsible for 57 metrics for a given patient. And there was something else that said if they did everything that was required of them by either the administration, by policy, by the payers, it would require about 27 hours for a given patient panel in a day. So not enough time in a given day for them to comply with all these measures that we're putting on them in the value-based care world or these other non-fee-for-service arrangements. So
I was going to ask you, do you think that you've been infected by the same nonsense in the corporate world, which, because you mentioned 57 metrics, I mean, that's nonsense. I mean, but the corporate world is completely infected with the OKR frameworks now, the objective and key results, which is littered with, you know, endless KPIs to ensure you're meeting your OKR objectives. Do you think the healthcare industry is as badly impacted as that?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, HF.
I think, as a matter of fact, you know, healthcare systems, we're trying to model, you know, model ourselves after, you know, we have OKRs, we have KPIs, we have a...
HF is the chief quality officer for the system. How many metrics are you responsible for improving?
You know, I can't even count them. I mean, there's over 100, And even our internal quality scorecard has 30 or 40 metrics on there. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do now is, you know, trying to apply that 80-20 rule to all these metrics. Okay, which 20% really have the biggest impact, not only on, you know, the quality of care that we provide the patient, but also, you know, the incentives that we get from the payers, because, you know, value-based purchasing, 2% of our payment is at risk. And, you know, we're looking at, okay, which of these metrics drive that 2%, you know, are going to allow us to recoup or keep that 2%. It's very complicated and complex.
I mean, I will say that I am under no, I have no illusion that every medical professional from training through to their professional execution now is caring and focused on the patient outcomes. I'm absolutely convinced of that. But I also believe that you're probably being pressured, or the system is constraining you and pressuring you and pushing you and forcing you to maximize the return on investment for the companies that you work for, the hospitals, the healthcare businesses. And so there's a tension in this fragmented system where maybe the incentives become misaligned, the profit purpose motive becomes vague or grayed. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. I think patients get caught in the middle of that, of course, you know, so you've got, you know, their reduced value through delays or pre-authorizations or refusals of pre-authorizations. And so they're worried about suboptimal outcomes. I mean, especially if you're a patient with a terminal illness, but there are some extended life approaches that can give them another 3 months, another 6 months. I've seen a lot of that conversation even in the UK, as most listeners will realize. I'm an imported American, an adopted Texan, as my wife calls me. But in the UK,
you gotta work on your southern drawl, you know.
Yeah, you can get that, y'all. So, but it's in the UK, you know, everything is, you know, and I'm using air quotes here for the listeners, is technically free. Of course, it's paid through by taxes, and there's only a certain amount of taxation and allocation from the government and a certain budget, and everything has to fit in that budget. So the inevitable consequence for value delivery to the patient is they're not worrying about being paid. Well, the patient's not worrying about paying, but, you know, the hospital is still worried about being paid by from the budget allocation they've been given, and therefore waiting lists grow exponentially. These are unintended consequences, especially for elective care. And then some of these treatments to extend life when you're in a terminal case become unobtainium for people, patients, because the government won't fund them, the National Health Service won't fund them, and the patient can't afford to fund them. So I think the problems exist even in what's technically a state-provided free healthcare system, which is, you'd expect to be more focused on patient outcomes, but then there are unintended consequences for that.
So in taking it back to value and thinking really from the patient's perspective, what do you find valuable when you go to a healthcare provider, or you have a service done in a healthcare system, versus what the payers or somebody else is expecting the hospital and the physicians to do? And there is a big disconnect. One thing, NHF, and I deal with this all the time, is we are encouraged by insurance companies, et cetera, to really capture the complexity of each and every patient as fully as possible. Now, why are we encouraged to do that? Because they're more willing to pay, they're going to pay more for a patient that is complex versus a simple patient. So if you came in and HF took out your gallbladder, and he also documented, along with taking out your gallbladder, that you, you know, had heart failure, you have diabetes, you have end-stage renal disease, you have X, Y, and Z, that make that care very complex. It makes what he's doing harder, for sure. But he's still doing the same procedure. He's taking out your gallbladder, whether or not you have those things or not. That he is now encouraged as a very skilled surgeon to spend a lot of time in the note writing what he did for the heart failure, for the diabetes, for all these other things. In the past, in the straight fee-for-service world, he wouldn't have mentioned those at all. And now we spend countless hours encouraging physicians to do extra documentation about these things. We add additional technologies to make it easier for them to do that. We have people that come behind him and check whether or not he added those. And maybe that's value added for the insurance company. Maybe that's value added for the health system. Probably not something you would be willing to pay for out of your pocket for him to document those things. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because there's a, when we work with the Lean and Six Sigma practitioners out there, there is a definition of value. And one of those this is a four segments about what's value added, what's not value added. But one of the things is the customer's willing to pay. Assuming they understand the value of the work being done, that they're willing to pay. Now, of course, a lot of what you've just described is hidden in the 80 plus hour weeks that most medical professionals are putting in. Nobody believes that people are working 35, 40 hour weeks in the medical profession, and it's all just turn up and wave your magical diagnostic wand and walk away again. I think as a patient, if I look at it from a patient perspective, as somebody myself using patient care regularly, because that's getting old, it comes with the territory, you know, we don't want to be waiting. We don't want unnecessary testing. We loathe the administrative inefficiencies. We may have different ways of describing that, but we loathe all that. I mean, I get bills for my bit that I didn't pay 6 or 8 or 9 months after the hospital or the doctor service visit. And I'm like, I don't even remember what this was for. And I have to go back and start researching to figure out whether I should pay the $100 they've just billed me. Right. And whether or not, and even now, when I've exhausted my out-of-pocket maximums this year, I'm now starting to look, I'm still paying. When I go to see a specialist, they're still asking me for my $75 or $100 copay. And I'm going, well, hold on a minute. I've met my out-of-pocket maximum. Why is your system not seeing that when you connect to the insurance that I should not be now paying because I've paid the maximum I'm supposed to pay? So those sorts of things that I start to look at from a patient, as well as, am I getting the right quality of healthcare? Am I getting the responses quickly enough? I just had an MRI and it took 10 days to get the results. And yet my out of pocket was a few hundred dollars because I'd met certain criteria. So those are the things I'm looking for as a patient from simple. And of course, I put my Lean head on when I start to think about efficiency, about quality, about am I getting the right information, the right results in the right timing. Then because I'm a Lean guy, I start to think about variability and, you know, utilization and constraints and capacity. The average patient doesn't think about that, of course. They just think about, well, I went to the doctor and I paid this money and I'm expecting these results, or I'm expecting the right healthcare. And as an example, I had a reason to visit a digestive doctor recently, and he gave me some advice based upon some MRI results. And then I talked to my surgeon who repaired a small hernia I had and some months ago, and I asked him about these MRI results, and he's a chief of surgery at UT Southwestern, so I'm assuming he's pretty skilled and experienced, and he gave me a different response. And so now I'm going to go see him in a month's time and just have a look at these MRI results, see if there's any cause for concern. But that's the type of thing that I look at when I talk about patient value, or the value as a consumer of these medical services, the delays, the right testing, the right results, the right diagnosis, the access to the right diagnosis or the right testing sort of regimes. And that's where I think there needs to be certainly a level of focus. But the challenge with that is that you have all this other stuff going on in your world that pulls you away from that. And then these are the systemic pressures that say, yeah, but we're not getting paid for some of that, Nigel. So I don't know, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated.
It's a complex system. That's the whole point, you see.
But Nigel, I do want to pivot just a little bit and talk about value and flow within an organization. You know, ultimately in the healthcare business, we think of you know, the patient being our ultimate customer. But we fail, I think, sometimes to think about our internal customers and the importance. You know, for instance, you know, it's important for me to show up to the operating room on time, you know, because those people in the operating room, they I need to view them as my customers because they are depending on me to show up so that they can do their job, so that things can flow. Tell us a little bit about the importance of the internal customer within an organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's always an interesting construct, because when we talk about internal stakeholders is probably the word I'd use as regards customer, because, again, that definition of who's paying. Well, they're not really paying, but they have an expectation of a certain delivery that you're providing. And that falls under the lean tenet of respect for people. So there are people who are relying on you to be on time, to show up in a condition that allows you to perform at your highest potential, highest level. And so that's a respect for people thing. And they are stakeholders. I mean, the patient's a stakeholder, of course, but those medical professionals within the organization are stakeholders and expecting you to perform effectively. I mean, when we dig into the reasons why we struggle to deliver effective service, whether it's to internal stakeholders or the ultimate customer that we see in our context, we start to talk about how the system functions. And we like to bandy this word around called waste. And what we really mean by that is activity that doesn't add value, non-value-adding activity. And that separates into two. There's what we call type one and type two. And we often use Japanese words because, you know, complexity people use big words, large vocabulary, because it makes them sound clever. And lean people use Japanese words because it makes them sound clever. But effectively, the Japanese word is muda, for just a generic word for waste. And it's broken into two pieces. Type one is activity that doesn't add value, but is currently unavoidable, and business or systems or regulation has to change to avoid having to comply with that activity. So that's the regulatory, and you're in a heavily regulated industry. There's all the, you must fill in these forms, you must submit these things, you must ensure you are compliant with certain things. It's hard to avoid that without some intervention beyond our direct control. Although sometimes the regulations tell you you need to be compliant with XYZ, we then invent crazy processes to be compliant. They don't actually tell us to do that. We just do it because we're humans and we tend to do silly things like that. But then there's this other bit, type two. And that's everything else that we do. And what we need to do is be constantly, and this is your ethos of Kaizen, continuous improvement, operational excellence, whatever word you want to use, is looking for where there is non-value-added activity in the process of delivering your services, in your case, patient care and everything that surrounds that. So even on your journey to the OR, there could be a multitude of things that would delay you or interrupt you. And then we can talk about context switching waste, which is, you know, outside of normal lean thinking. But this is the thing, when you're in the zone, you're focused. We talk about flow in multiple contexts, and flow in that sort of being in the zone, that psychological construct from Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, which was a Hungarian-American professor who sort of wrote the book on mm-hmm. psychological flow. And that's something you guys should be familiar with. You're in the zone. So you're geared up. You're in the zone, you're heading into the OR, you know your patient, you know where you've got to deliver. You may have a whole day of operations to perform, of procedures to perform. So you're in that zone. And then you get interrupted. You know, your app on your phone goes off that interrupts you because somebody needs you, or somebody else distracts you, or somebody's, you know, almost chasing you down the corridor, distracting you and pulling you out of flow, pulling you out of that. You're switching context to deal with whatever that thing is. Not only are you late, you now have to adjust your thinking to get back into the, what was I thinking? Where was I heading when I was heading to the OR? What was on my mind? What was I planning to do? What was my specific areas that I'd actually made decisions on? So this is all part of examining non-value-added activity, how we eliminate that. Notwithstanding, keeping 57 metrics on something, all the quality metrics, all these other OKRs, all this other nonsense we have to do because somebody who doesn't do the job decided it was valuable to do. And this is the other thing that I talk about a lot is the people closest to the work know how to get the system working effectively. And that's the whole idea of going to Gemba, being present where the actual work is going on. Now, I'm not meaning drag the hospital administrators into the OR, although occasionally that might not be a bad idea to give them an understanding of what you're coping with. But it's the people who are running the system, whether they're running factory machinery or writing software or looking after patients as you do, those are the people closest to the work. They know what it takes to ensure the system runs effectively and efficiently. And there's a difference between effectiveness and efficiency. You can efficiently create waste, you know, is the old saying or the old adage. And then the people who manage the system, who aren't the people doing the work in the system, need to have a deeper understanding of that so they can eliminate all the burdens and the constraints to the system. And some of you may be familiar with what people call 5S. Toyota call it 4S. The problem is two of them are the wrong way around. The standardized bit comes before. It's the third level. And that's the responsibility. And we did a paper in this for the American Society of Quality, co-authored this with a lady in Germany who's a deep lean expert. And essentially, the standardization is the responsibility of the manager, the supervisor, the executive, whoever, to create the system and the conditions so the people performing the work can perform them the most effectively, the most safely, and the most efficiently. And we sometimes miss this because these people are creating these elements to the system to ensure they meet their metrics and measures that they've defined, yet they've never done the work. And they really need to understand how the work is done if we're going to eliminate all these things that ultimately cost the provider money, the insurance company money, the government for Medicaid, Medicare, and also the taxpayer, as well as the individual patient who has got a copay and a co-insurance. Sorry, I threw a lot at you there, but I went off on one.
Right. I do have a question. Just want to get your thoughts. In regards to flow, several years ago, we had there's a book out there called Hardwiring Flow. Two ED doctors wrote it, Dr. Mayer and Dr. Jensen. And they mentioned something in their book that really resonated with me. You know, flow is hard to define, but they equated flow with anything that's adding value to the patient or to the customer. And I want to get your thoughts on that.
So flow is a construct. I mentioned this in a preamble that it's like gravity. It just exists. Now, my work on flow, we translated our work into multiple languages. And interestingly, in German, flow only has one meaning, and that's related to rivers. So, you know, and because if you look at a river as a good analogy, it's continuously moving body of water. And as we place obstructions and constraints, rocks or whatever, it finds a way through. It restricts it and it becomes more costly with the energy it's using. So when we start to look at flow from a value perspective, my focus has always been on the flow of value. My Toyota roots help there. But when we start to look at it in these different levels, and I should get my thoughts right, there are different constructs of flow. There's the individual construct we mentioned, which is psychological flow. There's a social construct, which is how we collaborate, interact, partner with each other. There's the concept of one-piece flow, which comes out of manufacturing, which is a consistent, stable throughput of value. The amount of things we make in a given amount of time is stable, predictable. And of course, you're not in an industry that's predictable. You're in an industry that is full of challenges and unpredictability in a complex system, not this linear causality system. So we have to sort of start to look at what we mean by that construct when we're applying it. Now, if we're just talking about the flow value, anything that presents an impediment or a constraint to delivering the value, and we have to define that value because we've had that long conversation, then anything that presents an impediment that impedes that flow or constraint is the antithesis of delivering that value with the minimum amount of resistance. So I wrote a definition which talks about, and I don't have it in front of me, and I never remember my own work, but this continuous flow like a river. So I've not read the book. I've just pulled it up, so I'll look at it later, the Hardwiring Flow book. The challenge is that a lot of people who are systems thinkers, and we probably count ourselves all in that, see things in linear causality terms. We don't see things from a complexity thinking or complexity science point of view, which is that unknowable stuff, the unpredictable stuff, and how we deal with that. And all we can best do is put in place mechanisms for when we have these emergent elements that occur, that we can actually deal with them in a favorable way. We try and plan a nice algorithmic process for everything that can possibly occur, but we can't always do that. We can't have answers for every unknowable situation. But at the simplest level, when we start to talk about flow, is how do we eliminate all unnecessary constraints or impediments to delivering value once we've determined what that value is? Because if we don't determine that, then of course we start making the wrong changes to the systems we have in place, and we get unexpected results, unintended consequences, which is why the definition of who is the customer is really important. Because if you're optimizing for, and I'm sorry to bring it back to this, but if you're optimizing for the insurance payer side of things, that may have a different outcome than if you're optimizing for the patient outcomes in this. And that's where it really is important to define the customer or the receiver of the value, because then you optimize the system to deliver that value flow, or that flow of value. Now, can we do both? Of course, but there will be some compromise. There will be this tension between, you know, what the internal stakeholders want, what the insurance companies want, what the patients want, and hey, you know, even what the taxpayer wants when we get into providing healthcare to those that can't afford it.
Oh yeah, a lot of content for our continued conversation. Well, Nigel, unfortunately, we're at the end of our time, but the good news is we've got at least two more of these episodes coming up. Nigel, on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much. Great conversation, and we look forward to hearing more.
Thank you. I have time to prepare.
Thanks, Nigel.